Start things off with Professor Cindy Bies from Southern Illinois University. Professor Bies, thanks for hopping on with us again today.
Happy to be with you.
It's great to be able to chat with you. We had a lot of great feedback the last time you were on, so no pressure.
It does create a high bar.
Yeah, right, it does. No, you are so good at explaining immigration law. So I want to start somewhere different. We talked when Title 42 was expiring, and we'll get into that a little bit later on about how things are going right now. I first just want to ask a very general question that probably could be take hours to answer, but just in summary, how hard is it to legally immigrate to the United States? Is it a long process? Does it depend on where you come from, how you're getting here? Can you walk us through like the legal channels in which people can come to the United States?
Yes, you're right. We could talk for hours about that question. And I guess the short answer is it's not that easy. It usually does take several years, at least for someone who wants to come here on a permanent basis and become a lawful permanent resident and a citizen eventually.
Right.
If someone's coming temporarily, it's a different story.
Right.
But for immigrants, yeah, and there are basically three big categories. Either the biggest category is for people who are sponsored by a family member who's already in the United States. It could be a U.S. citizen or someone who's already a lawful permanent resident here. The second biggest category is work visas. Mm-hmm. So if you have an employer that sponsors you. And then the third biggest category are refugees and asylees. So those are really the three primary ways that people come.
Right. And when we say legal permanent resident, that basically is someone that's here on a quote-unquote green card, right?
Yes, that's okay. Right.
All right. So when we hear green card, that's someone that is here legally, permanent resident. They pay taxes when they work. They have this, I don't want to say the same rights. They don't get to vote, right? I think that's one difference. And then you mentioned work visas. And sometimes work visas lead to people eventually meeting someone in the United States and marrying them through that other way. And I'm speaking to that because that's what's happened in my marriage and happened here. met someone here on a work visa and we went through the legal permanent resident process, which even for something like an open and shut, like easy, obvious case was not easy. Took a lot of forms to fill out, a lot of money as well. And then it's that third basket. And when we talk about migrants here in Chicago now, but mainly on the southern border and some are bused elsewhere, it's usually people in that third category, right?
Yeah, and, you know, in legal circles, there's often a difference between migrants and either asylum seekers or refugees.
Well, explain that.
So migrants may often be coming seeking economic opportunities, but if you're a refugee or an asylum seeker, you're fleeing persecution back in your home country. So someone who's seeking a better life, who's seeking a job, you know, better economic opportunities may not actually fear persecution in their home country and therefore wouldn't qualify to be a refugee.
So are we using the term migrant incorrectly then?
Sometimes, you know, it's a big basket and you don't know until you've sort of had the person go through the process and tell their story whether they would qualify for asylum. So it's hard to categorize an entire group without knowing the details.
That's true. Okay, so after Title 42 went away, which to remind people, I think I can sum it up, was a Trump-era holdover that was passed, or not even passed, didn't pass, it was from the CDC essentially saying, during this COVID pandemic, this crisis, we are going to limit people that can come into this country. We are going to immediately have the ability to expel them if we don't see their asylum as a legitimate thing, and we can kind of choose which countries they can or can't allow people in. Boy, I'm doing a terrible job explaining it. Why don't I just let the expert do it? Was I at least on the right foot there, Professor Bies?
You are on the right track. Yes, Title 42 refers to a public health law, and it was invoked during the COVID pandemic, at the height of the pandemic, to essentially largely shut down the borders, not 100%, but to allow the administration to quickly expel people who are trying to enter the United States without giving them the ability to apply for various immigration relief. And as you alluded to, that policy has now come to an end as of May of 2023.
If I'm an asylum seeker, how do I get into the United States now?
Really the same way that you always did. So to apply for asylum, you have to be physically present in the United States. You cannot be in another country overseas to apply traditionally.
So I just have to cross the border, you know, in some way, some shape, some form?
Yeah, so, you know, some asylum seekers would come on temporary visas, like as students or tourists or that sort of thing, and then apply for asylum after they got here. Some people would cross the border illegally and apply, you know, as soon as they arrived in the United States. Some people crossed illegally and waited a long time and then applied at some later date. So there's a variety of ways that people might get here and then apply for asylum after they're here.
If I come across the border illegally and apply for asylum, and let's say it's ultimately granted, is there some punishment for having crossed illegally in the first place? Or is that seen as just, hey, that's how you got here, that's how you get to get here, but once it's determined that you are here legally, we wash that away?
Yeah, basically it is forgiven, with the understanding that you were fleeing persecution and you probably didn't have time and ability to go through the, you know, the proper legal channels. Because a person who's truly being persecuted, you know, fears serious harm from either their home government or some actor in their country that their government is unable or unwilling to control. And so we do forgive people for arriving without the proper documents or in the proper channels because they are fleeing out of, you know, fear of their lives.
If I'm a refugee from Venezuela and I am coming into the United States through Mexico, could one make the argument of, hey, you're out of Venezuela, you're in Mexico, you don't fear that same persecution, I'm sorry, but you don't have asylum status here in the United States. How do we treat that if they've passed through another country that isn't, that they don't fear?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it's one of the things that our government's really struggling with right now, that some asylum seekers could apply in some countries along the way, rather than trying to come to the United States. And in fact, the Biden administration has now implemented a policy that does ask for certain asylum seekers to do that, to apply or at least to show why they didn't, you know, apply or were denied asylum in another country before coming here. For some of those folks, they may be able to find asylum in other countries, but many countries do not have a robust system for admitting people seeking asylum. They may have very limited numbers of people that they will accept. And so it may not really be feasible to apply in some of those countries either. And that's really why this is a regional issue for us at our southern border. You know, we need the cooperation of the other states in Central and South America to really make it work and to sort of spread that burden out of, you know, taking care of people who are fleeing serious danger, but who also can be a burden on the countries where they end up.
Is Mexico a country that the United States feels doesn't have, doesn't take on enough asylum seekers, or is that more of a gray area in terms of our relationship with Mexico?
I would say that's a gray area. I think Mexico has, under some recent agreements that have been negotiated with the United States, agreed to step up what they are doing with asylum seekers. They may also be stepping up their own border enforcement at their southern border to prevent more people from entering and transiting through Mexico. But I do think that Mexico is making more effort to improve their asylum process and to accept more asylum seekers.
That's interesting. It does remind me a little bit of the situation happening in Europe where we have a lot of people seeking asylum into the EU, and their natural port of entry, the closest place they can get to, is Greece, and Greece is having real big issues with refugee seekers, asylum seekers, and the rest of the EU is trying to work with Greece to make it a little bit to lessen their burden, but also, I don't know, I'm going on a tangent here, but I guess it does sometimes take entire continents working together to try and make it a tenable situation. Do you kind of understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, there are a lot of parallels. We've certainly heard the tragic news stories of the loss of life in the Mediterranean Sea. I think the estimates are around 400 already this year have lost their lives trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea to Europe. And you're right that many of them land in Greece, also in Italy, Spain, some of the other southern coastal city or countries in Europe. But Europe has a better, more integrated system. You know, they've been working together through the European Union for many, many years, decades, And while they haven't fully integrated all of their asylum processes, they probably do a better job, you know, having that experience of working together in other areas in trying to share that process and process those refugees and get them spread out throughout the EU. And of course, different EU countries are more receptive or less receptive to asylum seekers there as well. But yeah, I think there's a lot of parallels and there are lessons that we can learn about regional cooperation and failures. I mean, EU doesn't always get it right either.
Right. No, for sure. And it kind of varies depending on the year, right? Like we've seen a welcoming of migrants, and it depends on where they're coming from. Let's be perfectly honest as well, too. That plays a huge role. And that does as well here in the United States. So bringing it back here, let's say someone is seeking asylum in the United States. Are they treated the same? Like, is the process similar whether you cross the border illegally or legally? Like, are your chances better if you went through the border legally than illegally? Or is it once people are corralled for a, it's a terrible term to use, but once they're brought in the same place, it's kind of the same pathway?
There are a couple of differences in the way that people can apply for asylum. So if they are caught and found to be doing something illegal in the United States, and the government seeks to remove them, they file what's called a defensive asylum application, and they may be detained in immigration detention while their process proceeds. If they are here lawfully, like let's say they came as a tourist or a student, and before their temporary visa expired, they filed for asylum, then they are not detained. They are allowed to continue, you know, doing whatever they were doing before they filed their asylum application while they're waiting for their asylum hearing to take place. The government also does not detain every asylum seeker, even if they are present illegally. Frankly, we probably don't have the bed space to do that. Mm-hmm. And so they make some decisions about whether folks are dangerous, if they have, you know, perhaps they have someone they already know here that they can go and stay with, that sort of thing. And particularly since COVID, when the government tried to reduce the number of people in detention to reduce the spread of disease, they've been detaining fewer asylum seekers. And so they don't have to sit in detention. They can, you know, stay with friends or family or something while they're waiting for their process to go forward.
Last time when you were on, you talked about that there's like a temporary, just a quick check, just to see if the story holds any water about why you're seeking asylum. If the government feels like there isn't, they can send you back. If they feel like, hey, there's at least something here, there's a case to be made, you're here and you await a court date that is supposed to be somewhat quick, but takes a long time to happen sometimes, especially nowadays. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Okay. So they will initially have what's called a credible fear, reasonable fear interview. And, you know, if that story, as you said, sort of holds together, it seems credible, and they seem to fit the category of someone who may be eligible for asylum, then they are referred into the asylum system and they wait to have sort of a full hearing before an immigration judge. And you're right, that can take, now, on average, I think it's somewhere between 4 and 5 years to get a hearing before an immigration judge because the system is so backlogged.
When can you start working?
So if you have a non-frivolous asylum application that has been filed and accepted by the government, you have to wait at least 6 months. And then after that time, you can obtain an employment authorization to allow you to work and support yourself while you're waiting for your hearing before the immigration judge.
Is that an easy process to go through?
It's not terrible. Okay. I mean, you know, in the world of immigration, that's probably one of the easier things to do.
That timeline makes sense because now we have seen some of the Venezuelan asylum seekers here in the Chicago area. I've talked to construction companies, other companies where they have started to have some of them apply for jobs and get hired. Okay. Do they get a Social Security card?
Many will, yes. Even if they don't have a Social Security number, they will be assigned a taxpayer identification number. Uh-huh. And so they can and do pay taxes.
Do they get to get any of those benefits? And please let me know if anything's beyond, you have obviously a wide breadth of expertise here, but if we're getting into tax law and it's too far, let me know. But do they Do they get Social Security, or is that dependent on them eventually winning their case and being able to stay here on a legal permanent basis?
Yeah, it would depend on what happens to them in the future. And so that's been an ongoing point of negotiation. I'm going to take you back in history just a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Back when President Bush was in office and President Vicente Fox was in office in Mexico, they had started to negotiate agreement where, like, agricultural workers in the United States who paid into our Social Security system could have a retirement plan that would be sort of jointly managed by the two governments. And, you know, if they went back to Mexico, they could use retirement funds that they had banked in the United States, you know, later in Mexico. Unfortunately, September 11th, 2001 happened, and all the immigration deals were put to the side, and that never became a reality. But there was discussion at some point of making that work better than it does now. So many people do pay into the system and don't collect from it at the end of the day.
So there's many retirees right now who are part of their Social Security is paid for by immigrants or asylum seekers here in the United States that pay taxes and may never get anything in return from it.
That is true, yes.
Okay. Cindy, we could do a full hour. We will do it one day, I promise. But unfortunately, there was a big situation in Russia that we had to devote some time to in a little bit. So, Professor Bies, I really appreciate your expertise on this. I promise we'll do it again soon. And thank you so much for your expertise.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
That's Professor Cindy Bies from Southern Illinois University.